This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With summer coming up, I'm already dreading not only the traffic on the roads, but also the increased cost of groceries and the fact that my children eat all day long. You know, we all have stressors. Some are big and some are small, like an increased grocery bill. But therapy is a safe place to actually get these stressors off your chest and to figure out how you can actually work through them. There are many benefits to therapy for people from all walks of life. It's helpful to learn positive coping skills so you don't freak out about that grocery bill, and how to set boundaries. Therapy can empower you to be the best version of yourself, and it isn't just for those who've experienced major trauma. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's convenient, flexible, and entirely online. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/Russell Moore today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Russell Moore.
This episode is brought to you in part by Zondervan, publisher of Ghosted, An American Story, written and narrated by New York Times best-selling ghostwriter Nancy French, and is available everywhere audiobooks are sold.
Welcome to The Russell Moore Show. I'm Ashley Hales, the producer of The Russell Moore Show, and we love to talk about some questions. Russell has been a steady voice amongst tumultuous times, and he really has so much fun answering your ethical questions, as well as just helping us kind of chart our way forward in this year, 2024. So here we are, Russell. You excited to dig in?
Yeah. I don't know how steady my voice is, but I was just telling somebody on a plane last night about a woman who told me, I remember right where I was in Austin, Texas, after preaching at the Austin Stone, who said, I listen to the audiobook of Adopted for Life every night because it helps me to sleep.
Aww.
And I said, a compliment? I don't know if it is or not. So
actually, one of our mutual friends, DT, was talking about, we have a soothing voice combination, apparently. So
hopefully
that will help, or, you know, as we talk through some of the challenging things of this year.
Everything's going to be okay. You're getting very sleepy.
Perfect. We get a lot of questions about your newsletter as well. So, and we address some of your reading, of course, in our quarterly books episodes. But this question comes in a lot, so I just thought we'd throw it in a Q&A. Do you read all these books that you list every week in your More to the Point newsletter, cover to cover, in a week? And if you do, can you give us some reading tips for the average reader?
No. I said when I do this, I'm talking about books that I am reading in. Some of them I don't finish. Some of them I don't read. I read a section of and I don't read others. But these are things that I have kind of on my nightstand at the time.
Gotcha.
So my rule of thumb is, unless it's something that I think it's really important for me to read this, whether I like it or not, mm-hmm. I'm going to get into it and decide, this is for me or this is not for me. Or sometimes this is for me, but it's not for me right now.
Right.
And I put it aside. The only exception to that that I can think of is a three-body problem, mm-hmm. because I have a group of friends who said, you've got to read this and you've got to keep at it because you're going to want to give it up a third of the way through.
Yeah.
But it will pay off in the end. And it did. So
I love that. You're motivated by friendship rather than guilt as far as finishing the book.
Well, it's kind of guilt because I knew that when we got back together, they would say, what'd you think of the three-body problem?
Right.
And yeah.
Yes. So. Accountability.
Who wants to deal with that?
Yeah. No, no. But this isn't a books episode, so we will just take your listener questions. Again, if you have a question for Dr. Moore, we always would love to receive those. You can email those to us at questions@russellmoore.com. And today, our questions really help us to understand, hopefully, the state of American evangelicalism today. A few questions really came to the fore about voting. So one particular listener writes in and says, 4 years ago, when she was trying to find a trustworthy fact-checking resource, she stumbled on the Dispatch. Her question, as she's kind of reading things in the Dispatch and she's trying to get balanced news sources and is feeling the pull between her faith on the one hand and her duties as a citizen, is it okay for American Christians not to vote for a president?
Yeah. And I'm not saying that that's what you necessarily should do, mm-hmm. but I did a piece for Christianity Today in 2016 about the fact that one actually does not have to choose between a lesser of two evils. Mm. Now, what that is arguing is to say to vote and to not vote for president, well, that's not what I'm recommending, actually is a sign of something. I mean, you can see that with, for instance, think of the Alabama Senate race in 2017. Judge Roy Moore was the Republican candidate, had these allegations made against him. There were a large number of people who simply left this blank because, you know, for whatever reason, they couldn't vote for Doug Jones, but they couldn't vote for Roy Moore. They left this blank. Well, that mm-hmm. that actually did say something.
Right.
So I think that I wouldn't bind anybody's conscience in terms of whether they, you know, leave a particular voting slot blank mm-hmm. or whether they write in or whether they choose a candidate.
Yeah. I think that's restraint often we think of as a nothingness, right? But it actually, self-control is a fruit of the spirit, right? And yeah. So there's ways in which that also says something. So
I have a woman that I know who said, my husband voted for you for president and Ben Sasse for vice president because he wrote it in. This was in 2016. Then sometime in 2021, she was telling somebody, she said, my husband voted for Ben Sasse for president and RDM for vice president. And I thought, well, what did I do in 4 years? Got me demoted to Ben.
Man. Well, that's a good ticket.
Kicked out of the Oval Office.
That's a good ticket. Yeah. Oh, man. You know, as we think about how to relate in the world as citizens, there's also a lot of ways in which it, of course, impacts our family life. And one young adult writes about his situation with his parents supporting Trump. And he's worried just about, he says, I know my relationship with God should not be affected by politics, but the evangelical support for Trump makes us look exceptionally hypocritical. And particularly he's feeling that strain in his relationship with his parents. We've talked, of course, on the podcast a lot about kind of the way politics has split up families But I wonder if you could just address that briefly. And then secondarily, if you could help us think through, what does that do for that word evangelical, you know, that the evangelical support of Donald Trump?
Well, there's a lot there.
I know. You've already written a book on that. Yeah. But yeah. Here we go.
I mean, when it comes to relationships, you have different kinds of relationships with different people. Mm-hmm. And so your relationship with your family is very different than your relationship with maybe the people in your political party or something like that. And so what I have recommended, and actually what I have done, I mean, there was somebody in my life that I care about who doesn't like my position on Trump, sees that as non-Christian, mm-hmm. and wanted to take that up. And I said, you know what? I'm more than willing to debate Donald Trump. I do that all the time on TV and other places, but that's not the kind of relationship I want with you. Mm-hmm. And so you're not going to change my mind. I'm not going to change your mind. We're going to maintain our relationship so far as I can, which means that this isn't what we relate about. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't mean, oh, this doesn't matter. I mean, obviously, I think this matters a lot. It's been the last 10 years of my life. But not every relationship has to be that way. So what I find is if you say to somebody, look, I really need my mom and dad. Mm-hmm. We disagree about this. Can we just be mom and dad and son or daughter and not engage on this particular issue? I have found that most people are responsive to that. And then most people fall off the wagon a mm-hmm. little bit. Mm-hmm. And you remind yourselves, oh, wait, we're not going to do this. So yeah. For the most part, that works. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I would recommend that. And, you know, the Bible says, so far as is possible with you, live peaceably with all people. It might not be possible with you.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a personality, what should I say, an all-encompassing sort of movement by nature. And so sometimes that's going to be the case, but I'd give it a shot and I'd give it a try.
Yeah.
And so when it comes to the whole evangelical Trumpism thing,
yeah.
I mean, obviously, I'm not going to rehearse everything I've said about that. I've said a lot about that. What I would say is I say something different, not something contradictory, but I say something different to evangelicalism writ large and the kind of person that you're talking about right now who says, I'm really disillusioned by this kind of thing, which, you know, what I would say when I'm speaking to everybody is this is a disgrace that you have people who are disillusioned, not because they reject Jesus, but because yeah. they, you know, but to that person. And I had someone who came up and said that, and I decided, I wouldn't always do this, but in that moment, I decided this was the kind of conversation, the kind of person who actually needed this. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, let's talk about your idolatry of Donald Trump. Hmm. And he said, no, you don't understand. I'm anti-Trump like you are. And I said, yeah. I said, but what you just told me is that you're walking away from Jesus because of Donald Trump, and Jesus is not entangled with Donald Trump. And it's difficult because, and he responded well to that. It's difficult because we live only in one particular moment. And so if you're living in 1516, you're probably going to say Christianity is nothing but a marketing scheme for indulgences. Mm-hmm. That's an important observation to make. And that needed to be made. But if the response to that is to say, therefore, I'm not even going to consider the claims of it anymore.
Yeah.
You're not keeping faith with the whole big, broad sweep of Christianity. Mm-hmm. Now, if I'm in the Vatican in 1516, mm-hmm. then I'm going to say, turn over tables or whatever, to say this is awful what you're doing to people like that. But when I'm talking to that person, I'm going to say, don't let them do that to you. If mm-hmm. you conclude, I can't believe the gospel, mm-hmm. fine. If you conclude, I can't worship in this particular context, I need to be in another context, okay, fine. If you say, I don't want to label myself the same thing that I used to because it's yeah. confusing, fine. Mm-hmm. But just don't let the craziness of what you see right now with this tiny little mm-hmm. sliver in space and time of the Church of Jesus Christ drive you away, especially when Jesus is the one who went out of his way to tell us that this would happen.
Yeah,
he told us that so many times. So we can't really say to him, hey, you didn't warn us about what the church could do.
Yeah. And I think that's so important because we can get, in the same way that you know, sin makes it, as Martin Luther talked about, like that we have this kind of inward curve and we can only kind of see things from our perspective. It sounds like you're reminding us too, we can also do that historically.
If you think of Lewis's chronological snobbery,
yeah,
it might be kind of the mirror image of that,
yeah,
and a sort of chronological cynicism,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's, I mean, and again, it's totally understandable,
right?
Because we're designed to see the church around us and in our era as being an embodiment of the kingdom of God and demonstrating in word and spirit the presence of God. So when it doesn't, that is an awful thing.
Yeah.
But don't give them the keys of the kingdom of heaven in that way.
Right.
To say if you're not in our political movement, you're exiled. And there are a lot of people who want to do that. But ultimately, Jesus gets to do that. And he has said he's not doing that. And so we just need to be faithful to him.
Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by the Truce Podcast. I'm sure you've been there. You're at an event, a dinner, a small group, and someone says something like,
"If you're a Christian, you have to vote Republican."
Huh. That raises an interesting question. How did evangelicals like me get to the place where we just assumed we'd all vote one way? This season on the Truce Podcast, we're diving deep into the complexity of the 1970s and 80s to understand how evangelicals tied themselves to the Republican Party. It's a story that involves murder, corruption, redemption, and our need to be heard. I'll be talking with celebrated historians like Rick Perlstein, Pulitzer Prize winners Francis Fitzgerald and Jesse Eisinger, and some of the best guests I've ever had. Truce is the show that uses journalistic tools to look inside the Christian church. We press pause on the culture wars in order to explore how we got here and how we can do better. Subscribe to Truce anywhere you get podcasts or listen at trucepodcast.com.
As we think about what does it mean to use that term, evangelical, what do you think is the proper use, or is that a personal issue of conscience, or how do we reclaim it? I'd be curious just to hear in this moment in time how you see the benefits and cons of using that word in a wider public sphere.
Well, evangelical is just a shorthand for a particular kind of Christian coming out of a particular kind of revival and renewal movement. So to some degree, the kind of conversation that we're having now around that has always been the case. Because if you're saying, you know, 15 years ago, okay, evangelical applies to Billy Graham and to Kenneth Copeland. I mean, there's no overlap between those two figures, but it is useful because you're saying what Billy Graham is rooted in and doing for, in my view, for good, Kenneth Copeland is using the same sort of streams to use for, in my view, evil, but that's where the power is coming out of that stream. So there's something that in terms of a category can fit both of those people. So that's always been the case. For me, I don't think it matters what you call yourself. Mm-hmm. Most people who are evangelical Christians don't really think of themselves as evangelical Christians until they're having to describe what kind of Christian they are. And that's why I say I'm not ready to give up the word. Mm-hmm. What I don't want to do is to say, okay, we need to take the word back.
Right.
I realize that my kind of evangelicalism is a minority within white American evangelicalism, obviously. I don't think it's that far out of step with global evangelicalism, although it would be in the sense that I'm not Pentecostal and, you know, but that's, I think we have to say this is a way of being evangelical. And what I mean by that is I believe the Bible. I think that the new birth is necessary. People come before God one by one. through personal faith in Christ, and that God periodically shakes up and revives the church. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to give that word up.
All right. Well, let's transition into Christian nationalism to keep things interesting. Heather from Florida writes that she is feeling just so lost in Florida. She says, your podcast and latest book have made us feel not so alone. But she's wanting help to begin to parse Christian nationalism. So in her longer email, she talks about some of the churches they've attended and all of the, you know, the pastors are quoting Fox News, maybe more than the Bible. And working for institutions, she has in the past anyway, that talk about this linkage between America on the one hand and Christianity on the other hand in ways that feel like it's more than patriotism. And so she's trying to ask your advice about how do we begin to understand if something is simply patriotic or if it has veered into Christian nationalism, especially, you know, interpersonally, when you begin to have those conversations with people who are a part of that institution, and they're like, oh no, we're not Christian nationalists, but it looks as if it would definitely fit that box. How do we begin to both deal with that interpersonally, as well as thinking more broadly about what is Christian nationalism? What's the line?
Well, I think there is a kind of person who doesn't help the conversation by defining Christian nationalism in ways that sound like Christians who care about their country and want to right. be politically or civically active. I mean, and so this is typically the same sort of person that would have been saying back in the George W. Bush administration, this is a theocracy. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's crazy.
Right.
And so if that's the way you think, you probably need to sit this one out because the stakes are too high here. Mm-hmm. Christian nationalism has a couple of components. One of them is the use of Christian symbols, images, or doctrines as a means of an ethno-nationalist end. Mm-hmm. You can see that in different contexts all over the world. And then the second component is there is a unique kind of covenant between America and God. So what you end up with is a kind of outward conformity mm-hmm. to the law of God without the gospel. Mm-hmm. And so I think for her, what Heather mm-hmm. should think through as she's going through this, sometimes you're going to have people in churches who are, you know, you pick up something that you have heard and you use it. You know, mm-hmm. So for instance, for a long time, kind of civil religion, which is different from Christian nationalism, but they're on a spectrum in mm-hmm, some ways, mm-hmm. would use 2 Chronicles 7:14. One historian called it the John 3:16 of American civil religion. If my people are called by my name, humble themselves, turn from their sins, turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and I will hear their land. Mm-hmm. They're applying that to the United States of right. America. When the context of 2 Chronicles is applying that not just to the covenant people, but through the place of sacrifice. Right. This is blood atonement. So when you bypass that, you're bypassing Jesus, and that's a big deal to do. But there are some people who have just heard 2 Chronicles 7:14 used that way for a long time, and so we'll just say, hey, let's pray for our country. If my people are called by my name, they do that. That's not necessarily a problem.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a problem, but right. it's not a...
It's sloppy. It's not...
It's yeah. sloppy. It's not intending to do that. One of the things that tends to happen, especially in evangelical Christianity, is so much of what happens is trickle down and imitative, which can be good or bad. I mean, a lot of really successful evangelism programs and recovery programs and other things did their work because people knew of other churches that were doing those things, and then they started doing them too. They maybe didn't even know where they came from. Hmm. Or a lot of, for instance, good policies when it comes to background checks for nursery workers, and we don't give a child over to a parent unless they have this P piece of paper to scan or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. A lot of that is coming from, well, we saw that done and we're going to do it. That's good. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it works in bad ways too. Mm-hmm. So you might have to discern, is that just what's happening? Are people just saying what they think they're supposed to say? Or is this actually a Christian nationalist sort of congregation?
Yeah, that's helpful. It gives us a lot of latitude in which to engage charitably with folks too.
What I loved most of all about Israel and why I became a Zionist was because Zionism was a rejection of victimhood.
A few weeks ago on CT's The Bulletin, we launched Promised Land, a new podcast about Israel and Palestine in a post-October 7th world.
6:30 a.m., we're in our synagogue praying, and sirens go off, and they're going on.
Based on interviews and conversations captured on the ground in Israel last November, it's an exploration of the spiritual, political, and historical roots of the conflict.
When there's a weak Israel, every Jew in the world is weak.
And why should a Russian Jew who has nothing to do with this land come here? Why? Well, I mean, if you want, you can give them Texas. You love them so much.
I am alive because I didn't come home. But all my friends that were here were murdered. Here, over there.
This week, Promised Land moves to its own feed. You'll find links in the show notes. So if you haven't heard it yet, you can go catch up and catch the new episodes as they come all in one place.
We have a question about both sidism, which you wrote about recently in one of your newsletters. And we have a thoughtful response that I'd like to bring up about the difference between both sidism and one sidism and institutions. So I'll just read this for a moment. This reader writes, "I wonder whether the origin of what you call both sidism about actions like the Hamas attacks on Israel actually comes from one sidism about institutions. I think the root of much of the moral relativism may be in a reflexive support for particular institutions. So whether it's the Palestinian people, the Israeli people, a Republican or Democrat party, Christian denominations, etc. I think this is what you may be getting at when you point to signs that help one recognize if you have outsourced your conscience to some ideology or sect." I thought it would be, thoughtful and helpful for you to comment on where does both sidism come from? And is it kind of like this, you know, in the same way we were talking about the evangelical movement, and, you know, we can think of that in terms of belonging, belief, and behavior. And so if we belong to this group, right, that we therefore are just going to kind of defend that group. So is that accurate? What would you say about that?
Well, I think that when we're talking about both sidesism, in that context, it was having to do with the morally revolting thing that was happening at the end, still is in a lot of sectors. And like so much of the horseshoe theory, the far right and the far left converge here, which is to say, when asked, is the Hamas terrorist attack on innocent civilians wrong? Well, you know, you have to keep in mind what Israel's doing with whatever. I'm not a reflexive supporter of the modern state of Israel. I don't think the modern state of Israel is a fulfillment of biblical Israel. I think it's a small L liberal democratic state in a sea of authoritarian dictatorships. Mm-hmm. And I am more supportive of Israel than I would be of Yemen or Saudi Arabia or Iran, but I don't think I don't hold the old dispensationalist view that those who bless you, I will bless, refers to the modern state of Israel, and those who curse you, I will curse. Yeah. What I do think is raping women, murdering civilians, slitting the throats of children is wrong. Full stop.
Yeah.
And so when you find yourself in a situation where what you're doing when confronted with something that's happening in your group of belonging, whatever that is, mm-hmm. is to say, yeah, but what about them? You may well be in danger of moral relativism.
Right.
You know, one of the dangers of the kind of belonging and loyalty that we have in so many ways in 2024 world is what George Orwell talked about when he talked about nationalism and said it's not just that nationalism gives you a set of talking points to believe, it often prevents you from even knowing about the sins that are happening on your side. So mm-hmm. you don't even see those things or recognize those things. Mm-hmm. So for instance, I mean, we had a pro-life event every year coincided with the March for Life that had to do with a consistent ethic of life. We'd mm-hmm. talk about a variety of different things. You'd have two kinds of people who were there for the most part. You'd have the people for whom getting up and preaching a pro-life sermon on abortion would get them applause mm-hmm. because the people in the congregation were politically already aligned mm-hmm. there. But if they said, hey, we've got a refugee kid moving in that we mm-hmm. need to minister to, they would get a very different response. Mm-hmm. And then you'd have the kind of person who has the reverse.
Right.
They could get up and talk about the poor. They could talk about refugees. They could talk about immigrants. They could talk about the. But if you bring up the unborn, now you're, and it's for the same mm-hmm. exact mm-hmm. reason. Mm-hmm. And so what has to happen is if you're going to have a sense of moral consistency, to be able to constantly be asking, okay, what, who are the people, and it's usually people, who are the people that it would be better for me if they were invisible to me?
That's a great question.
And I think that's what Jesus is getting at with the what we call the parable of the Good Samaritan. Mm-hmm. This man doesn't want to think about a Samaritan mm-hmm. actually fulfilling the commandment to love neighbor by mm-hmm. acting mercifully. And all of us have those kinds of people where if we even stop to think about them, it's a sign of disloyalty.
Right.
And this is a morally dangerous place to be.
It is. Yeah, because it's amazing how, right, if you are in that kind of ghetto, the echo chamber of like a one-sidedism, it's amazing how it's always you who's right too, right? It's always your group.
Yeah, and also it's not just, it's your group. And what you'll notice over time is that as the group changes, the group demands that you change with them.
Right. Yeah.
On those sorts of things. There's nothing wrong with changing. You know, you should change your mind on all kinds of things. That's what growth is about, but not as a way of proving loyalty to the group.
Yeah. Well, you know, these are questions that are really at the forefront of a lot of Americans' minds, particularly. And we've had some comments too from outside of the US, which is always really fun. So we don't want to alienate our non-American listeners. But you know, as these questions are coming up in our hearts and minds as we're navigating what sort of media we're consuming, as we're thinking about conversations with parents and children, and as pastors and leaders are thinking about discipleship and thinking about how is the upcoming national election going to affect my local church? Help leave us, you know, with a bit of hope or maybe a little practical starting point. You know, if some folks are just feeling the impending panic of a national election later this year.
Yeah. Well, whenever anybody says, leave us with some hope, I kind of grab my wallet, because usually what people mean when they say that, if you press it a little mm-hmm. bit further, is not hope, but reassurance.
Yeah.
And everything is going to be okay. Mm-hmm. Well, ultimately, yes, mm-hmm. everything is going to be okay no matter what happens. But that's not what I think hope is. And I think that for some people, it is reassuring to think, well, everything will be fine. I don't know that that's true.
Yeah.
What I can say is that Jesus will build his church. Gates of hell will not prevail against it. I know that. I can say that in terms of the United States of America, we have been through trying times before. What gives me pause with that is that there are a lot of other countries who went through trying times before and then yielded to something awful.
Yeah.
So that could be the case. So I think the way we ought to think about it is, and not just about sort of whatever craziness waits for us this year, but sort of generally, is Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, when they're being put into the fiery furnace, their response is, God can deliver us from this furnace, but if not, we still will not bow down to your golden God.
Yeah.
So that can apply to absolutely anything. God knows the hairs, the number of hairs on my head. God cares for the sparrow. God knows where I am. He can deliver me even if he doesn't.
Yeah.
I'm going to trust him because he is ultimately going to deliver me, even if it's at resurrection from the dead. So you hold on to that. And then I think you it's kind of similar to the question you asked earlier about the person with the parents. There's a concept, as you well know, in a certain strain of Reformed theology, but I think it applies to everybody in some way, of sphere sovereignty, which if you boil it down to what's applicable here, it's that you have different responsibilities and some different roles. And so I think of Richard Mao, who gives the example of a woman who is a school administrator and a mom and an elder at her church. And she has a son who works for the school and is a member of the church who has been stealing from the school. If she responds to him as principal the way a mom would, she's not fulfilling her duties as principal. If she responds to him like a principal when it comes to her relationship with him as a son, she's not fulfilling her responsibilities as a mom. So you have different sorts of, they're morally consistent. You have to have a moral consistency, but you have different kinds of responsibilities that are necessary for you there. So you have responsibilities, those who are Americans, as American citizens, to the Constitution of the United States and to the general welfare, as the preamble would put it. And then you have responsibilities as Christians to maintain a consistent witness for the gospel, and you have responsibilities as sons or daughters or moms or dads to maintain relationship through all of it as best you can.
Yes. Well, thank you, Russell, for your words of wisdom, as always. So many people are really looking to you to help us cut a path through to help us remember that the bigger picture, right, is God's kingdom and the message of the gospel, and that Jesus will not forsake his church. So thank you, as always. It's always fun to chat. And listeners, we'd love to get your questions. So for a future episode, be sure to email us at questions@russellmoore.com. If you enjoy The Russell Moore Show, take a second to share this episode with a friend or leave a rating and review wherever you get your podcasts. The Russell Moore Show is a production of Christianity Today. Executive producers are Eric Petrick, Russell Moore, and Mike Cosper. Host is Russell Moore. Produced by Ashley Hales. Associate producers are Abby Perry and Mackenzie Hill. Director of Operations for CT Media is Matt Stevens. Audio engineering provided by Dan Phelps. Video producer is Abby Egan. And the theme song for The Russell Moore Show is Dusty Delta Day by Lennon Hutton.
This episode was brought to you in part by the Lord of Spirits podcast. Many Christians yearn to break free of the influence of secular materialism and to understand the union of the seen and unseen worlds as made by God. What is the spiritual world like? Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.